That's great. Thank you. Hi, my name is Michael DeWilde, and I'm from Detroit, Michigan. Motown, the Motor City. Yeah. I've already made one mistake. Broke a cardinal speaker's rule, and that is starting with a clip or playing something that's far more interesting than you yourself are. So now you're thinking to yourself, all right, I got 25 minutes here. We could listen to DeWilde, or we could just play the album. I think I know what I would choose. Speaking of choice, one Marvin Gaye anecdote for you as well. Personal encounter with him. I was living in Boston. By the way, I loved your version of What's Going On. It's great. Living in Boston, and I was out on a date with a very attractive woman to whom I was very attracted. And it was getting late, and we were thinking about heading home. And we were passing by one of the finer hotels in Boston, and boom, a limo pulls up, and out steps Marvin Gaye, who clearly had just given a performance of some kind. Not a large guy, but just exuding charisma, sensuality. I mean, he was a beautiful, beautiful man. And the woman that I was with sort of looked at him, kind of glanced at me, sort of, took a long look at the door to the hotel, clearly weighing her options. And in that moment, I have to say, my regard for her, my esteem for her went up, because here she is out on a date with me, clearly attracted to Marvin Gaye, so obviously her taste both in men and music is impeccable. So. All right, a little bit about what's going on, the song and then the album, just a little bit of context. It, like so many great pieces of art, one of those that almost never saw the light of day. By the time it got to be the late 60s, Marvin Gaye, who was a huge hit, the Prince of Motown, the Prince of Soul, they were calling him, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, had the number one bestseller for Motown to that point. But he was getting a little tired of being pigeonholed, which is what Motown tended to do. They thought of themselves as a factory and factory lines, and people had their kind of category, and they needed to stick with it. And Obie Benson from the Four Tops came to Marvin Gaye with a sketch of What's Going On, what became What's Going On. It wasn't fully fleshed out at the time. But he had brought it first to his own band, the Four Tops. It was based on his observation when they were in San Francisco of things that were happening in People's Park in Berkeley, where the long-haired hippie kids, who they felt some affinity for, were being beaten up by the cops. And Benson started asking himself, what is going on out here? What's happening to my country? And he wrote down some of the notes for what became going on. His man didn't want it. So that's a protest song, man. We don't do that. And so then he encountered Joan Baez. And he played kind of some of the rudimentary chords and some of the ideas for her. She passed on it. So he brought it to Marvin Gaye when he was back in Detroit. And Gaye said, that's really interesting. I'm producing a band right now called The Originals. And Ben said, no. He said, this is for you. Said, this is, you have to do this, or it's just going on a shelf somewhere. So he sat down, Gaye Benson, a guy named Al Cleveland, who was a lyricist, and fleshed the whole thing out and got some studio time, brought in David Vandepit, who was the arranger for Motown, some of the strings from the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, I mean, everything that goes into layering. The musicians loved it. James Jamerson, who was a legendary, innovative bass player, part of the Funk Brothers, who lived in Studio A, the basement in West Grand Boulevard in Detroit, where Motown was located, put it together. Everybody fell over themselves. This is the best thing ever. What a great, innovative, revolutionary piece of music we've produced here. Took it to the one man who could veto it, Berry Gordy, of course, who ran Motown. And Gordy's response to it was, that's the worst piece of crap I've ever heard in my life. He said, I'm not releasing that, not now, not ever. Well, Marvin Gaye went on strike. So along with Diana Ross and the Supreme, they're two you know, there were Hitsville, USA. They really were. I mean, they had a ton of hits. They were printing money, but at the same time, they really needed Diana Ross and what Marvin Gaye brought. So Gaye goes on strike in this kind of typically passive-aggressive fashion. And finally, convinces what's called the Quality Control Board at Motown and Berry Gordy, you know, I'm never stepping foot in here again, never do another thing for you if you don't release this. So Gordy holds his nose, he releases it, it sells 100,000 copies in 1 week. Gordy, knowing which side of, you know, the bread is buttered, goes back to Gaye and says, oh, you want to make that album now? He said, you got 30 days. Turns over the studio and the Funk Brothers to him and gives him 30 days. Now, Gaye had a bunch of notes and some musical ideas. He and David Vandepit and the Funk Brothers go into the basement and just stay there for a month. There are 3 days of actual recording. And, you know, in 1971, we get the seminal What's Going On album, which changes, I think, it certainly changes my life, but it changes an awful lot of people's lives. And it certainly changes Marvin Gaye's life. And here's one of the things that he said leading up to the production and the release of it. He said, in 1969 or 70, I began to reevaluate my whole concept of what I wanted my music to say. I was very much affected by letters my brother was sending me from Vietnam. Frankie Gaye, his younger brother, did a 3-year tour in Vietnam. As well as the social situation here at home, I realized I had to put my own fantasies behind me if I wanted to write songs that would reach the souls of people. I wanted them to take a look at what was happening in the world, what was going on. And by the way, when Benson brought the ideas for What's Going On to Gaye, it did have a question mark, what's going on, question mark. And by the time Marvin Gaye got done with it, it was what's going on statement. There wasn't, they took the question mark off of it. The themes, if you haven't listened to it for a while, and by the way, if What's Going On is not on your top 10 list of albums of all time, we can still be friendly, but it's not like we're going to hang out, okay? So, it's that good and that important. The themes, war, peace, ecology, poverty, politics, and salvation. If you know the album, you know a lot of the spoken word that was informed by his own religious leanings and spiritual tendencies. He said in a number of interviews afterwards, he said, I didn't want race to be a part of it. I didn't want to play it up, even regardless of what had happened, obviously, in Detroit in the last 3 years since the 67 riots. As a white kid growing up, in and on the outskirts of Detroit, the minute I heard the music, black music to me, and the minute I got to Inner City Blues, which is probably my favorite cut on the album, said I can't hear Inner City without thinking about black as well. So for me, it does have, I'll be upfront about it, clearly racial implications, racial insights. And even though the Funk Brothers were a revolving group, there were about 12 or 13 of them, some of the most accomplished musicians, not only in Detroit, but in the world. They were mostly black, but from the producer's point of view and Berry Gordy's point of view, if you could play, you could play. So there were some white guys in the mixes as well. But here's how Marvin Gaye is 19 years older than I am. So I'm this 8-year-old kid in 66. And these are the kinds of factors I think of, the kind of timeline of events that I think both of us are hearing, and not just the two of us, of course, but the world and our part of the world. He's living in a house on Outer Drive about 20 minutes from where I grew up. And so let me just read it to you, if you don't mind. 1966, I'll turn 8 in October. I get a small tableside radio and CKLW, 50,000 watts of broadcasting power are now at my disposal. I spent a lot of time in my room. CKLW is housed in Windsor, but make no mistake, it's of the Motor City, very much a vehicle for Berry Gordy's Motown, which is in its heyday. In 66, You Can't Hurry Love, Ain't Too Proud to Beg are just two of the many Motown hits that capture my attention. And for the first time that I can recall in memory, I hear Marvin Gaye's voice in a duet with Kim Weston. It Takes Two, which if I could sing, I'd sing a bit of. But unbeknownst to me, there's a cadre of musicians behind all that music. It goes by the name of the Funk Brothers, working out of a basement studio on West Grand Boulevard in the city that lies just down the street from me. I'm a GM baby, like most of my friends are automotive industry babies. A Tigers fan, Ernie Harwell's baritone, also another soundtrack of my boyhood. Detroit is a melange in my mind. We go to games, to music, to visit my grandparents who are still there. My parents, even though my father was an immigrant, comes of age in Detroit. They work in Detroit. They go to Wayne State University. My father listens to WJR on the radio on the way to various, you know, driving adventures, hits from the 30s, 40s, and some 1950s. I learned the Great American Songbook, but from that radio next to my bed, there's something else happening, something that will forever separate my generation from his, a revolution in music led by what I'm supposed to believe are two equally suspicious, if not dangerous, forces. Long-haired hippies playing their rock and roll music, and black people, soul, rhythm and blues, jazz, gospel roots. I don't know. I don't know about that. In my curious, impressionable 8-year-old mind, both groups seem pretty cool to me. In 1966, U.S. forces in Vietnam, approximately doubled to 400,000, 6,000 American casualties, 61,000 North Vietnamese combat deaths reported. In ecology, and a background for the songs on the album, right? War, peace, ecology, poverty, inner city blues. Smog and a heat inversion in New York City kills over 100 people. In Detroit, a deep economic divide plagued the city. Black Detroiters disproportionately faced unemployment rates were roughly triple those of white workers. While white employment sat at about 6%, black employment was about 16%. Largely due to discriminatory hiring practices in factories. And if you know anything about the history of Detroit, you know that black communities started their own automobile unions within the factories because of how bad conditions got, specifically for black workers. 67, I'll turn 9. Motown hits. The Happening by Diana Ross and the Supremes. Jimmy Mack by Martha and the Vandellas. Ain't No Mountain High Enough by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. There he was again, Marvin Gaye. The alternating structure of that song, the harmonies, the soaring chorus. It's heart-stopping, that song. And I felt it. What's happening to me? 9, 10-year-old kid just getting a musical education from pressing my ear to this sort of legendary musical station. I was also fortunate in that my mother was the musical director of our church, by training an opera singer, but she had an ear and an affinity for all kinds of music, and so in our church, she brought in elements of gospel and Negro spirituals. So it was all from that all the way to Bach, so a pretty good musical education in terms of the background. But I never heard anything like Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell singing together. If you haven't listened to Ain't No Mind High Enough in a while, I recommend it to you. Then the Detroit riots. What do I do with that? All my heroes are black. Sports heroes, musical heroes, Martin Luther King. And even as a young kid, I'll admit it, a little bit precocious, if not pretentious. Malcolm X, I was interested in all of that. I was trying to, poring over Life magazine, you know, late 60s. What in the world is going on? It was the sort of guiding question. So what do I do with all my heroes are black? And by the way, telling myself, there's only one thing I want to be when I grow up. I want to be black. That was, of course, before I grew up and knew enough to know that's not actually a great thing in this country. But I gave it one of the very few, maybe outside of this one, autobiographical talks that I was asked to give by somebody. There were maybe a couple hundred people in the audience, and it was one talk I've given, and I give a lot of talks, as you know. The one talk my parents came to, and I did mention this in the talk. I said, I remember being 10, 11, between the sports figures and the music. I said, why would you want to be anything other than black? And I said that in the talk, and afterwards my mother came up to me and said, you wanted to be black? I said, that's all I ever wanted to be. And she looked at me with this mixture of concern and confusion and said, oh, and walked away. And I'll talk a little bit later, towards the conclusion, about what I have tried to do with that in my life and what the influence of Motown and this particular album have meant on that, sort of finding that balance between Detroit in the hands of at least some measure of the black community after the 67 riots, the message we got as white kids. And by the way, after 67, we moved from pretty close proximity to Detroit to 40 miles away. We were part of the white flight, definitely. 11-acre gentleman's farm. My father was willing to drive 45 minutes every day, one way and then back again, 45 minutes, to go into his office at GM so his kids could have a largely culturalist upbringing. I'm not sure what it was. But in any event, you know, the message was in the hands of the actual black community, Detroit was a dangerous place. And I remember in 1968, very clearly going down there for one reason or another, visit my grandparents or something. And my father saying, put your heads, so the three of us in the back, put your heads below the window. Didn't say why. All we had a sense, it was a vague sense that heroic on one hand, dangerous on the other hand, as a white kid wanting to find, you know, the best of it, what do you do with that? Especially if you're 10, 11 years old. It's both traumatizing and exhilarating all at the same time. In 1967, those of you who are around my age will remember we used to have a media that explained things to us and showed things to us in somewhat unfiltered ways. So the Vietnam War was, in fact, in our living rooms. You got a sense of that. What was going on. And in 67, 11,363 Americans killed, 99,000 wounded, 140,000 communist forces killed, hundreds of thousands of civilians. And again, if you're reading Time, you're watching the news, it's all there in pictures. I remember being in the fifth grade, had a progressive teacher. She had a picture from Time magazine up on the bulletin board trying to educate us about Vietnam and what was going on. And it was a South Vietnamese soldier who had severed the heads of two Viet Cong. And he was standing there with two heads. We're 10 years old. It's like, okay, I don't think this would happen anymore. And I couldn't sleep that night. And I remember going home and I'm crying all night long. It's like, what is this, you know, man's inhumanity to man? And again, everybody's trying to help me figure this out, but it's just getting worse. And I wrote a poem, a long poem that night, and I put it in. Gave it to this teacher, and she said, oh, I said, this is an amazing poem. I said, you know, where did this come from? I'm like, come on, lady. You're the one who put the traumatizing pictures on the board. Where do you think it came from? So all of that's in, again, part of my background, the black-white problem, inner-city problems, the Vietnam War in my living room, right? And then the soundtrack of Motown, which is largely upbeat. Right, Berry Gordy wants it that way. So we sell love songs and we sell hopefulness, and it's, you know, the groove is upbeat. It's nice walking basses and lots of, you know, orchestration. That's lots of major chords. And Marvin Gaye finally by 69 and 70 is not having it. In 1968, a scientist named Garrett Hardin wrote a famous paper called The Tragedy of the Commons. It explains how people often ruin shared resources like the ocean, clean air, and the land because they take as much as they can for themselves. So on top of everything else, it sounds like a history of victimization, but a lot of you were there. You're 10 years old, right? Cayuga River fire, the Torrey ocean spill, Vietnam War, the inner city stuff. It's like, okay, I mean, if you'd had the wherewithal, you would have sat your parents down and said, what were you thinking? What are you bringing me into here? And this song, Mercy, Mercy Me, is Gay's answer or response to the environmental hazard. I've played the song 10,000 times and never get tired of it. So not just the lyrics, you know, which are poignant in their simplicity, but the syncopation, you know, the sort of hitting, accenting the offbeats. What you're hearing there is just about every percussion instrument known to humankind. So there are five of the best percussionists in the world down in Studio A. And one of that pow pow sound, it's a wooden block curved with a hole in it. They're hitting it with a rubber mallet, and they've just got the reverb turned up to like 1,000. You know, if it's Spinal Tap, it's on 11. You know, so there's just a ton of reverb, and it's that pow that's just right, so earthy. It's like coming right out of the earth, right up to your feet, right into your gut, and you're just having this visceral response to it while he's singing these fairly elevated lyrics about pretty dark themes. So somehow you feel like one of the genius of this album is you kind of feel like moving and grooving, and it's lush. The orchestration is fantastic. A lot of jazz chords, major sevenths and suspended ninths, great stuff. And then you're singing along to the lyrics. It's like, oh, that's right, I forgot, we're doomed. You know? And they call it musical, it's a juxtaposition, bittersweet juxtaposition sometimes in musical terms. And you can't help but be drawn in because it's this beautiful misery being expressed in ways that's irresistible. So, mercy, mercy, me. In 69 and 70, White Flight begins in earnest in Detroit. Like I said, we were part of that. Detroit starts its long decline. In 1950, Detroit is the best place to live in the United States. It's the wealthiest place in the world. It has the most job opportunities. It's fairly well integrated in many ways. There's a growing black middle class. And in 20 years' time, you've got deindustrialization, redlining, school desegregation battles. The relocation of people like my parents triggers severe urban decay, drastically diminished tax base, and you all know what happens to Detroit up until about 5 or 6 years ago when in Midtown and other places it starts to build its renaissance. But if you've been there recently, you know that renaissance is fairly specifically targeted to places like Midtown, and there's still a lot of outlying areas that are pretty much a disaster. 69, I'll be 11. There are too many hits for Motown to even list. They just rule the roost, you know? It's their show. It's their ballgame. Too busy thinking about My Baby is Marvin Gaye's hit for then, and the Heard It Through the Grapevine, too. And then 71 comes, right? And What's Going On comes out. And people say to this day that if you listen to the whole thing, oh, Marvin Gaye was so far ahead of his time. He was just so prescient about race relations and the decay of the inner city and ecological disasters and the price of war and all the rest of it. I don't share that view. My view is slightly different. I think he's a perfect artistic mirror of that time. And it's an indictment of the rest of us, how little things have changed, that album is still so relevant, still so on point. So that's one takeaway for me from that. I listen to it, sometimes I'll go months without listening to it, and then I'll listen to it 8 times in a day, and I can still get choked up, especially with Inner City Blues. So can you play just a little bit of the Inner City Blues? And again, you want to listen to this percussion at the beginning and these bass lines, which are both melodic and counter-melodic, that are just blow me away. Thank you. That one late at night, if I sort of reflect, and one of the odd things about my odd career is that there was a point when I was running a program, prison program, where the Kellogg Foundation came to me and they gave me $200,000 and they said, can you run a program, develop and run a program that will turn returning black felons into leaders in their community? And I said, yeah, but like the optics aren't great, right? And they said, we don't care. And the guys didn't care. So there isn't anybody else to do it. You have to do it. And here's $200,000. What was I going to say? So this question of whiteness and blackness has, and Marvin Gaye may be much as anybody, you know, why have I spent a third of my career living and working in places like Chicago as a labor organizer, and then long stints in prison as a teacher, teaching mostly black guys. What has that been about exactly for me? How much did Motown influence that growing up around in Detroit? You know, am I really a justice warrior and should be applauded? Am I just like this pathetic wannabe? Is it white liberal guilt? Do I have some sort of strange savior complex? I mean, what is going on exactly? And maybe all that, probably all of that is true. But one of the reasons I included the James Baldwin is because he says this about that for somebody like me. Baldwin argued that American culture is black culture because white Americans' identities were formed through the subjugation of black Americans. He famously proposed that whatever white Americans do not know about black Americans, they do not know about themselves. Black culture, born out of forced survival, has inherently shaped the country's language, rhythm, and moral fabric. So, at my best, what I like to think is, all right, I'm trying to figure out what I don't know. And so much of that is rooted in black culture, which is so near and so far to my lived experience. So when I put on Inner City Blues at night, and very unusual for me, a tear forms, what I'm thinking about is all of those black folks that I've worked with over the years in one place or another, how different their lived experience is from mine, and yet how hopeful, buoyant, and strong that culture is. And my desire to know more about it and to be more respectful of it when I encounter it. In the meantime, what I'm hoping for, since Marvin Gaye unfortunately was killed by his father in 1984, what I'm hoping for is another Marvin Gaye or somebody like him in the next decade who can give voice, musical voice and lyrical voice, to what we are still experiencing, so many of the things that he so movingly, so beautifully left us.